I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Last year's talk about the propriety of Confederate statues has died down for the moment, but our reckoning with troublesome public art is far from over. Today we'll learn the history of changing perceptions in problematic art in the U.S., and we'll find out why this wave is just the latest in a long line of controversies. Then, a Kansas City Star piece over the weekend illustrated the importance of gas stations to a driving town like ours. Turns out some of these fixtures are failing their neighborhoods. We'll meet the reporter of the story and find out how community leaders are getting gas stations re-engaged. Later this week, State House Blend, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Public art. Now there's a term that can get people revved up. Back in revolutionary times, there was a lot of talk about removing the statue of King George III in New York back in 1776. More recently, we've debated the removal of Confederate statues and monuments. The U.S. has a long history of reckoning with memorials, monuments, and other forms of public art deemed oppressive, shameful, hateful, or simply out of sync with present-day values and ideals. Public art has been an issue around here, too. Example 1, the sculpture of that young bare-breasted woman, one thin arm extended, to snap a photo of herself at the Overland Park Arboretum and Botanical Gardens. Erica Doss is a professor of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and she traces how, why, and when Americans target public art and the dilemmas of dissent and historical accountability in public culture. And she joins us now by Skype. Professor, so nice to have you. Good morning.
My pleasure.
So this debate over public art, it obviously goes back a ways, right?
It certainly does. I think a lot of people think that the debate going on now over Confederate memorials and monuments, and there are more than 1,500 of them spread across the United States. Some people think that this is relatively new, but the fact of the matter is, as you put it, on July 9, 1776, patriots in New York toppled a statue of King George III and then proceeded to melt it down into some 42,000 musket balls, which were used by the members of the Continental Army. They were delighted to, you know, sort of fire at the British troops with what they called melted majesty.
So why does public art always wind up, it seems to stir such intense passions? Why?
I think because it's public. We spend a lot of time thinking about what to put up in the public sphere, and we're often very contested about it. And, you know, sometimes things go up and then we sort of forget about them. There's almost a sense of we have to put up a memorial or monument to pay tribute or to pay homage. But then things come back, and we really have to be accountable or responsible for what we've done decades, even centuries earlier.
You know, is there one debate, Erica, over public art in this country that sort of, you know, takes the cake as the most dramatic, enduring public art debate ever?
Well, I think that the debate going on right now over Confederate memorials it's really timely. It's really interesting. Most of these Confederate memorials went up between the years of 1890 and 1920, and then a second group were mounted in the 1950s and 60s. Hmm. And of course, that's long past the Civil War. The first group in 1890 to 1920 is really, those memorials are being put up during the era of Jim Crow. And the second group was put up during the era of civil rights. So, you know, we can look at them and really understand that they were put up as, you know, signs and symbols of intimidation against people of color. So now, in a very different America of the 21st century, we're reckoning with those. And people are increasingly calling for their removal.
This notion of second-guessing public art as the decades passed, that's nothing unusual either, is it?
I don't think so. I think public art is presentist. We put things up based on what we believe now, sort of the values that we currently hold. And as we both know, those values and those issues change over time. So what seemed important maybe 50, 60 years ago may not be so important today. And indeed, you know, values change.
If our listeners have thoughts and questions, comments about the removal of public art, maybe there's a monument or memorial in Kansas City you think needs to be gone, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, is the furor and the controversy over Confederate statues across the country, is that controversy beginning to fade a little bit?
I don't think so. I think that city councils and art commissions and the public in general are reckoning still. I don't think this is going to go away. But there are plenty of other memorials that are out there. For example, there's the Balbo Monument in Chicago, which is fairly near Soldiers Field, and it commemorates an aviator who, Italo Balbo, who was a fascist under Mussolini. This was a gift from Mussolini to the city of Chicago in 1934. And this has been sitting there for 80 years. And now people are sort of beginning to think, wait a minute, why do we have a statue from a fascist dictator in the middle of Burnham Park in Chicago? So it's one of many different examples around the country.
Yeah, actually, I've read that the nation has something like 700 public memorials to the Confederacy. Any idea of how many of them have actually been removed or moved somewhere else?
That's a good question. I would say that at this point, several hundred have probably been removed. Things are also in progress regarding name changing for streets and schools. And, you know, sometimes this takes a while. But I know that several hundred things have already been removed. A fountain in Helena, Montana, for example, was removed way back in August.
Well, maybe in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that a year ago, I wrote a couple columns for the newspaper here saying that the name of J.C. Nichols should be removed from the big fountain. That's the gateway to the Country Club Plaza here in Kansas City. You know, he did a lot to change our town, but at the same time, he also divided this city in terms of race, and that divide continues to this day. And I thought to myself, if the Confederacy, the old Confederacy, can make these changes down to the Deep South, maybe we should rethink what we're doing here in our backyard.
Absolutely. I think you're well within your bounds. And I think we need to remember, we change the names of things all the time. We rename streets, we rename buildings. You know, we put things up and we take things down. Nothing is forever. And in a sense, you know, we're a nation that's really built on fluidity and indeterminacy.
But what determines, I mean, what begins to start a movement to take a monument down? Because part of me, as I was thinking about this last night, you look at these public memorials and there is a permanence attached to them, maybe just only because of the materials that are used to create them. They seem like they were intended to be there forever. And so removing them takes a lot of energy, a lot of time, because people don't usually think in those terms. Is there something that tends to trigger a movement to take something or change a name?
You know, I think that the idea that what it's made out of, bronze or marble, somehow makes it more permanent, I think is, you know, we have to really reassess that. We take buildings down all the time. I mean, think about the great train stations in this country or, you know, really, really impressive pieces of 19th century architecture. You know, Manhattan is always changing its skyline. It is a good question, though. Maybe we shouldn't make things out of such permanent materials. Maybe we should really be thinking about temporary memorials, maybe using new technologies in new and inventive ways.
Well, I love this idea that I saw a column last night from Gail Collins. You were quoted in it. In fact, Erica, she's a columnist with the New York Times, suggesting that placing expiration dates on public memorials when they're installed might be a good idea. Now, that's an interesting thought to me.
Yeah, other people have voiced the same thing. Now, I would be hesitant about saying, you know, 1 year, 2 year, 5 years, 10 years. But I think we need to come to some sort of understanding that we change things. You know, things are in state or they're visible, but our ideas about them change. So maybe things are not as permanent as we think they should be.
Well, why did the controversy happen over the removal of Confederate statues when it did? Was there an event that triggered it in the last couple of years?
Well, sure. I mean, we've had some terrible mass shootings by white supremacists, at churches in the South, and the rally that took place in Charlottesville. And then, following that deadly rally in August, lots of city councils and mayors and governors around the country sort of took things into their own hands and said, I don't want this kind of trauma. I don't want this kind of murder on my hands. Let's remove things before they get out of hand, in terms of inciting another violent rally.
And obviously, there was a very strong reaction to those ideas. What did that debate wind up saying to you?
I think it's interesting. I find this very democratic, if you will. I find it really interesting that people are and continue to be very, very engaged in public art and public culture. We express our opinions in the public sphere, and we voice those opinions. And I think it's great that city councils and arts commissions around the country are listening to people when people say, hey, that's a blight on my city, or that's a blight on our nation, and really get us to rethink what we're putting up in terms of public art.
It really has resulted in a fairly powerful statement about who we are today versus who we were maybe 30, 40, even 100 years ago.
Absolutely, I agree. I mean, we're trying very hard not to be the people we were 50 years ago, 100 years ago, but we want to hang on to our, core values. So what's the art that best expresses those core values? And I think you would agree, there's a lot of public art up that does not.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about public art and what makes it controversial, what should happen to remove public art, what should it take to make a big decision like that and actually remove a piece of art from the public spaces around our city, around our country. 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Richard from Overland Park, good morning.
Steve, thank you so much. And I just find this such a fascinating discussion. I appreciate the opportunity. I had a thought about specifically in South Carolina and other southern states, the controversy over removing Confederate items, Confederate memorials and the like. And it concerns me in the context of, for example, European countries who have two, three, 500-year-old buildings, and give them a context for their own history, be it good or bad. And my point, and I'll take it off the air, is I would not be in favor of removing that piece of our history in an effort to wipe the slate clean of our memory of this travesty. The problem that we have is some people view that as a positive thing in history, whereas obviously others, including myself, view that as an extreme negative, but both have value in terms of putting historical context on America. So I wonder if it's not best to remove it, but add to that the verbiage in the form of a plaque, the context under which this can be viewed. Meaning, for example, here's a person who is responsible for trying to maintain slavery in the southern states, and take from that as you will. So my point is, further context as opposed to removal might be just the thing. And I'll take it off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, and to Richard's point, Erica, just so you know, when I wrote those columns last year about the J.C. Nichols fountain, having his name attached to that fountain, that was a very common suggestion I received from a whole host of readers. Just put a plaque up there, putting all this in context, as opposed to changing the name outright.
Right. This is a comment that lots of people make, sort of, contextualizing the public art that we have. One problem that we have is this. These Confederate memorials are, as you put it, permanent in terms of their materiality, right? They're made out of granite and marble and bronze. They're powerful, they're big, they're overpowering. Putting up a plaque is not necessarily going to counter their power or authority or their sheer visibility in the public sphere. They will continue to dominate. And in a way, I don't think it's a fair conversation between a plaque of explanation and then this continuing sort of power of a particular memorial. So, you know, I would love to believe that we could have the context and have the conversation. But I'm also afraid that these things will continue to assert their power and perpetuate really harmful ideas that we no longer hold to as a nation.
Again, we're talking about the value of public art and when is it time to change out items of public art in our public spaces. I'm visiting with Dr. Erica Rausch, and she'll be speaking about troubling memorials, problematic public art in America. It'll be at 2 o'clock Sunday at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in a program sponsored both by the Nelson Atkins, the Spencer Museum of Art, and the Kress Foundation Department of Art History over at KU. She's joining us by Skype right now. So that's happening on Sunday at 2 o'clock. So what's happening with all these Confederate memorials in the Deep South that are being removed? Are they being destroyed? Are they being moved to museums? What's happening with them?
That is a great question, and not very many of us know. And it's interesting. Some of them are being moved sort of, you know, very stealthily at the dead of night. A lot of people who are doing the removal are wearing masks and sort of disguising themselves because they're worried about social media backlash. Most of the mayors, governors, and city officials are saying that they're going into warehouse conditions. And I think they're sort of in a holding pattern. The fact is, so many museums are already cluttered full and underfunded. So, you know, I don't know where these will end up. One idea that I have is to sort of create what we might call a disgraced sculpture park, of which there are several in Europe. And this is where a lot of figures from the communist era have ended up. There's one outside of Hungary. There's one in Moscow. And
are they called
disgraced public sculpture parks?
No kidding.
You know, disgraced public art parks. And people go, but they don't go to pay honor or tribute to these things. They go and they see, you know, what used to be valued in the past and is no longer valued today.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they aren't destroyed, but they are certainly put into a very different off-site sort of context.
Let's go back to some calls. Paul from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I had heard that Robert E. Lee himself said that statues to him and other Confederates should not be put up. Is that correct?
I don't know that. I've never actually heard that. Maybe another caller might have the answer on that. That's sort of interesting, though.
I read it somewhere. You know, the problem I have is a lot of the statues were built or put up after the Civil War, long after.
Oh, yeah.
If you start looking at the history, they were put up during segregation as times. And they were traitors to the U.S. I don't know why we're, you know, having a problem with them.
I completely agree. I can't think of very many other countries where we put up statues and pay tribute to the losers of a Civil War.
And Erica, one of your points early in the program today was that some of the statues in connection with the Confederacy were put up in the 50s and 60s, 1890 to 1920, and they were put up to make a very powerful point.
Oh, yeah. They were put up to be, you know, intimidating signs and signals. A lot of them are put
that
right
African-Americans
on the
shouldn't push too hard because lots
That's
of people
right.
oppose what you're trying to do.
That's right. And some of them were put up on the edge of black neighborhoods, where, you know, so they were sort of imposing geographical borders as well.
You know, what is it about these memorials? Because, you know, once they're erected, it seems like a short time later they become sacrosanct in some very clear manner. You know, in Kansas City, we have these giant badminton birdies outside our art museum here that were installed, you know, a couple of decades ago. They were intensely controversial at first. And now, and I'm completely guessing here, that if there was an attempt to remove them, that a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people would go nuts.
Yeah, you know, those are by the artist Klaus Oldenburg. And I remember the controversy. And I think you're right. People would be really upset if they were removed today. And that's a great example of how, in a sense, values and tastes change. They're fun. They're funny. They're really visible in the landscape. I think that, you know, they work. They're not harmful. And that's the thing about these Confederate memorials and you know, other things. They are harmful. They say things about us that we no longer hold true.
Well, here's one. New York City has a statue of a doctor named J. Marion Sims. It's in Central Park. Dr. Sims is known as the father of American gynecological medicine, and he pioneered a surgical procedure to repair tears that some women suffer during childbirth. But it wasn't until fairly recently that people learned that the way he performed his technique and he perfected it was by experimenting without anesthesia on slave women. And yet the city can't get that statue removed.
Well, they are. This is one of several memorials and monuments in New York that was discussed by the City Art Commission that was appointed by the mayor back in September. And it's the only one that will be removed. I'm not sure where it's going to be moved to. It's already been moved a couple of different times in the last 50, 60 years or so. But it is definitely being slated for removal.
So it's going to go somewhere. Yeah.
It will. It's a reminder of a deeply flawed character. And what I think is really awful is it's right on the edge of a medical campus in Manhattan. So, you know, and it's been protested for well over two decades now.
Our producer, Danny Alexander, just came up with a quote from Lee that our caller may have been referring to. He said this, "I think it's wiser not to keep open the sores of war, but to follow the examples of those nations who endeavored to obliterate the marks of civil strife, to commit to oblivion the feelings engendered." So Lee apparently was suggesting something like that. That quote came from the PBS NewsHour. So apparently he was walking down that road himself. Before you go, Erica, one more thing. There's a bronze statue in Overland Park called Accept or Reject, and it depicts a woman taking a picture of herself partially nude. Now, a grand jury actually reviewed this statue and determined that it was art. It was an obscenity. I'm wondering if these kinds of statues, we've been focusing a lot about the Civil War, if these artistic kinds of statues fall into something of a different category here.
I don't think so. And I know the statue that you're talking about. And quite frankly, you know, I'm a big supporter for what artists want to do in the public sphere. But I just think that thing is awful. I just think it's a terrible statue. So I'm all in favor of folks doing stuff to it, perhaps. Oops, I shouldn't have said that. But in any case, you know, it's a problematic piece of public art.
Yeah, and it is very controversial. Parents take their kids walking through the park. They come around a corner, and suddenly there it is. And for some people, it's very upsetting, I guess. Yeah,
it's not the nudity so much. It's the way that the artist has carved up the figure, and she's headless, and you know, she's taking a selfie of herself. It's just sort of awful.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have to leave our conversation there. That's Erica Das. She's a professor of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and she'll be speaking again 2 o'clock Sunday at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, talking about troubling memorials, problematic public art in America. Thanks so much for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. We'll talk about another aspect of our public spaces, and that's ugly gas stations on Kansas City's east side. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, KCUR contributor and City Scene KC editor Kevin Collison gave us a rundown of Kansas City's development projects in the works now and coming up soon. You can find that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. Why did one Kansas town just give its mayor an $89,000 a year raise? Tomorrow we talk to Edgerton Mayor Donald Roberts about how the town's big intermodal hub has impacted the economy and what that could mean for other cities. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, gas stations are common east of Troost in Kansas City. Problem is, a lot of them are in bad shape. There are weeds galore, trash all over the place, and damaged storefronts that practically scream neglect. But some residents are fighting back, demanding that owners do more to clean up their businesses. And in some cases, it's actually working. Aaron Randall, the Kansas City Star, took a look at this situation and wrote about it in Sunday's newspaper. He's been a features and pop culture reporter for the Star since 2016. And Aaron, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
A lot of listeners might dismiss this idea that gas stations are important, but that's not the case in East Side neighborhoods. And I'm wondering why not.
Absolutely. I think that for many communities, gas stations are just, you know, they're amenities, right? But in, I mentioned this in the article, on the east side, they can often be lifelines. You know, when there aren't very many niche, you know, like eateries or convenience
grocery stores,
right? Yeah. Food deserts. These gas stations become catch-alls. And even for some kids, there are some kids who feel safer hanging out at a gas station during the day than they may feel on their neighborhood block. So a gas station really serves a multitude of purposes, which really heightens its importance in those communities. So it's actually very important to the east side.
So improving some of these stations, you can understand why some residents want to get that done, because for them, it's a big, big deal.
Absolutely. I mean, there are people who go to gas stations to get fluids for their car, to get the, you know, basic grocery knickknacks like, you know, milk and cheese and water. Like I see this on the daily. I'm a resident born and raised on the east side. There are residents who go to some gas stations because they have cheaper produce, cheaper vegetables than grocery stores may have. Or it's just like you say, it's in a closer distance than the closest grocery store. So it's definitely important.
You know, have these gas stations, Aaron, have they always been eyesores, or is this something of a newer phenomenon?
Well, I guess I can only use the anecdotal evidence that I have. And then, you know, just me growing up, for me,
you're still a young guy, so you wouldn't even remember back a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah, but I really don't remember them being, you know, kind of sources of pride, put it like that. And I did speak to a few, even like Councilman Jermaine Reed, who wasn't in the story, but I spoke to him on the issue, and he said he remembers growing up on the east side and knowing that stations were kind of a dump. And I kind of had an epiphany about 2 years ago. I was driving and I found myself stopping in, I believe it was maybe Leawood, and I was at a BP, and I was just flabbergasted by how amazing. I had never seen a BP station look that nice. Huh. I didn't even know that it was a possibility. Like it had brick. It had an in-house car wash. The inside of the convenience store was immaculate. It just kind of blew me away, and it kind of highlighted for me the difference between what the inner city and the east side has and what other suburbs may have.
So on the downside then, how bad are some of these stations? What did you find as you drove around?
In a few words, I mean, just...
They're dumps.
Yeah, they're dumps. I mean, just decay and neglect. I mean, some of these stations, one in particular, the pumps, the mid-grade and the premium pumps have been covered in cardboard and duct tape since I've been reporting on the story, which began in late January. Mm-hmm. There's trash everywhere. They're dimly lit, so it makes them kind of dangerous at nighttime when you're visiting them. Like, say you're alone visiting and the sun's down, you run the risk some of these places not even having light because the lights are flickering or they're going off. The inside, they're crummy. You can tell that they're not being cleaned every day. It's just really abject, just decay and neglect.
And it turns out that some of these stations have, in fact, become hubs for crime.
Absolutely. One term that one of the Ivanhoe neighborhood members used was an incubator for what she called administrative crime. One of the stations on 35th and Prospect is just really famous for just loitering and vagrancy and just people just kind of hanging out, you know. And it's not just the gas station. I have to be fair. There are some empty lots over there, and there are, you know, like other storefronts. But they say that a big part of that has been, you know, the gas station near where I grew up on 45th in Cleveland. A few years ago, the tragic shooting of Kavaye, I forget his last name, but his father was murdered, and he was paralyzed at a gas station, partly because the assailant was able to hide in many of the dark corners of that station and kind of scope out and wait for his dad to get there. Mm. So they can be incubators of crime and wrongdoing for sure.
Well, so it turns out that some neighborhood leaders have had enough here. Tell us about Pat Clark, president of the Oak Park Neighborhood Association, who's taken on the BP gas station. This is the one at Indiana Avenue and Linwood Boulevard. What's he upset about, and what's he doing about it?
Pat Clark, who is a great guy, firecracker, he's the president of the Oak Park Association on the east side. And I was really astounded by him, because when I was talking to him about things that I had found in my research, like going to the Secretary of State's office and seeing who owns these stations and who owns different ones around town. He had already kind of been doing his own reconnaissance and knew those stations. And he was upset about, for instance, because this particular station on Indiana and Linwood is across the street from Central High School. He didn't like that the owners kind of allowed the kids to just hang out, but not really provide anything constructive for them to do. There was no interaction between the actual attendants and the kids. He didn't like that the station was not employing people from the neighborhood. The station was not, you know, it wasn't keeping its storefront up to a certain standard, even though it had the means to. Just, you know, picking up trash, you know, making sure that all your pumps work and aren't covered in cardboard. Just, the, you know, the small things. He felt they had been there for 15 years. They weren't going out into the community and actually spending money in the community.
So what did he do about it, Aaron?
Well, Mr. Clark did, aside from telling them all the time that he was upset with what they were doing, was he kind of began to talk to another gentleman who is Jamal Farouk, who owns a Shell station. And I think a better...
Shell station that's in really nice, immaculate shape, right?
Yeah, and this is on 31st and, I believe, Brooklyn, not even half a mile from there. And a good example of, I guess, action, I think a better example, I should say, would be Karen Slaughter, who is the president of the Key Coalition neighborhood. Miss Slaughter, basically, when this Shell station came into the city a few years ago, she basically demanded that the owner maintain constant communication and become a part of the community that he erected his business in. So he couldn't just come to this community and, you know, appropriate these funds, get this approval, and not come to the community meetings. He couldn't not envelop himself into the community and really become an active part. And we see that when that happens, as in the case with this Shell station, the results are pretty awesome.
So the owners get to know the community, and that's a set of expectations that you probably wouldn't see on the west side of Kansas City, right? This is kind of an east side phenomenon, because what the residents there, they want these owners to sort of become part of the community and take some responsibility for what's going on around them.
Absolutely. And that's the interesting point that UMKC professor Jacob Wagner, who I spoke to, brought up. He said that many times community organizations on the east side are the strongest in the city because they have to be, right? So these communities, these organizations like Ivanhoe, like Key Coalition, like Oak Park, they are always fighting to figure out how to better their neighborhoods. And so they have to think in ways that other communities may not think. So that means, hey, if you bring a business into my neighborhood, I need you to try to be a part of my neighborhood, because as much as you need us, we need you to succeed.
I'm visiting with Aaron Randall. He's a reporter with the Kansas City Star, who had a fascinating story in Sunday's newspaper about ugly east side gas stations and what some neighborhoods are doing to combat them. So I guess maybe the million-dollar question here is, how effective are these community leaders at going after these gas station owners and convincing them to clean up their acts?
I have to say that the sample size is admittedly small, but it is batting 1,000 right now.
Really?
Yeah. You have Karen Slaughter, who worked, again, the Key Coalition, and the town of Fort Creek is actually where that same Shell station owner opened his first gas station. And Ms. Slaughter mentioned that she had kind of, you know, spoken with the town of Fort Creek Neighborhood Association to see how they interacted. They had a similar interaction. Voila, you have that great station. And then in my reporting, at the Star's request, at one of the, you know, the more poorly maintained stations on the Vineyard neighborhood, they finally met with the Vineyard Association.
You got them together, didn't you?
Yeah, and it was fantastic. I mean, on one hand, it was kind of astounding because it had been there for 15 years, not even a quarter of a mile from the Vineyard headquarters, and the Vineyard Association had no clue who the owner was. They had never met. You know, so it just kind of showed the chasm there, right?
How did the owner react to what the residents were sort of asking, is that him, I guess, asking him to do? What was he defensive, or was he sort of open to change?
And this was fascinating as well. There was no defensiveness. He was open to change. He actually, in their meeting, he suggested that that they work together to create a community day where he would supply all the food and the drinks and invite the neighborhood out to figure out how they can work together and be more of a community. And this was literally within 5 to 10 minutes of meeting. Now, this waits to be seen if it happens, but the goodwill was certainly there. It's just about actually breaking those barriers, I find, and having the conversation.
And the owners seem to acknowledge that, hey, if the neighborhood's happy, I'll be happy because more people will buy their gasoline at my station and I'll make money and the residents will be happy and away we go.
Exactly.
That's how all this works. Again, we're talking about ugly gas stations on the east side. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Vincent from Waldo, you're on with Aaron Randall, the Kansas City Star. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Real quickly, I was told a lot of times the reason why business owners need to be involved in the community, specifically black communities, is because usually products that are offered, especially with, you know, nationwide companies, are not geared towards black people. You take a Magic Johnson, for example, when he came in with Starbucks and black communities, he had to offer different products like sweet potato pie instead of scones, things of that nature. So it's beneficial not only for the community, even for the businessman, because you want to put products in your store that you know that community will buy. So that's why it's important for, and it's different because you don't have to ask that question, the West Side of
right.
Bruce, because typically we already know. So, you know, unfortunately, yep. Yeah, go ahead. I didn't want
to. No, I appreciate that, Vincent. I got to run here, but that makes sense to you, Aaron.
Cultural cognizance. That's what it is, right? I mean, just knowing your community, the more you know a person, the more better you can serve them and the more better your business will do.
Fascinating story. It was in Sunday's Kansas City Star. Aaron Randall, again, a reporter with the Kansas City Star. Thanks so much for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, we'll learn about expungement laws, why they recently changed in Missouri, and how they affect the estimated 1 in 4 Americans with criminal records. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.